You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Jarrett Ernest. Jarrett, thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure.
Jarrett, I want to talk to you about a number of things. There's books that you've edited and worked on, Tell Me Something Good, which is a series of interviews, as well as What It Means to Write About Art, a more recent volume, and of course your show at David Zwirner right now that you curated, which I saw the other day and is kind of wonderful and incredibly ambitious. So I guess I'd like to begin with how things began with David Zwirner. Obviously a very powerful figure in New York, great gallerist. How did the relationship with him begin? Because these books are published by Zwirner, correct? And so, and of course you're curating there too, which is an amazing venue. How did that relationship begin?
Well, the relationship began in the same way that all of my projects in the art world have really, or projects in general, have evolved, which is really from artists, from my relationship with artists that I meet, work on, connect with. And so for a number of years, I've been working very closely with Lisa Yuskavich, the painter, interviewing her extensively. I think that I had been interviewing artists for a long time and really thinking about that as a form and where it could go. And I wanted to create a relationship with someone that I would want to interview for like 20 years. And when I met Lisa, I knew that that was like the person, that was the right person. So I started working on this project with Lisa and researching her and writing about her. And through her, I met some people at David Zwirner. In particular, I met Lucas Zwirner, which is David's son, who at that time was taking over the David Zwirner books, which I think is described as an independent publishing house in the gallery or something. And I don't know exactly how it's phrased, but he had an ambition to publish books that went outside the scope of the artists that the gallery works with. And we became like immediate friends because we liked talking about poetry and philosophy and literature and art and at a very kind of rigorous and playful way. And when I conceived of doing this book of interviews that turned into What It Means to Write About Art, Lucas and I were already having regular conversations about art writing, the limits of art writing, who's doing it, what are different ways of doing it, how it could be made recontextualized in the contemporary moment. And it was very natural seeming that he wanted to publish it. And so that's through working with Lucas on a number of those projects, one editing the book of interviews from the Brooklyn Rail, Tell Me Something Good, and then doing this other book and a few other projects. I'm currently, after, you know, 6 or 7 years of work on stuff with Lisa, I'm finally writing like a long piece on Lisa, and that for a project that David Zwirner Books is also doing.
That's very exciting. And so I want to talk about, of course, the show, but to talk about a few of your books. Of course, the Tell Me Something Good is essentially a compendium of a lot of interviews that were in the Brooklyn Rail. A few of the interviews that I did with my wife are in there. And then the book that's more recent is What It Means to Write About Art. So to talk about that a little bit, I mean, you're talking with a lot of critics, obviously all critics, and mostly major critics. What I'd like to ask is, after interviewing all of those critics, you know, I have certain things I pull from, you know, maybe interviewing a lot of artists or other people in this series, which, among other things, is a love of the art world and what's happening. What did you find after interviewing all these critics? Was there an overtone or something you learned from all that, or that it leaves you with that we can talk about?
Well, I would say that having done the book gave me an extreme sense of permission, because you know, I interviewed 30 people for my book, and they're all mostly of a certain generation. That was really what I wanted to do, was capture these people who are now in their 70s and 80s that really created the terrain of art discourse and art criticism that the second half of the 20th century in New York really emerged out of. And as a way to understand what's going on now and what art criticism could be in the future. But through putting together these people, and it's people who are all very different. So there's kind of iconic art historians like Michael Fried and Rosalind Krauss and Lucy Lepard, and then with people who write for newspapers and magazines like Peter Sheldahl, Dave Hickey, Roberta Smith, Jerry Saltz, and then putting them alongside poets like John Ashbery, Bill Berkson, Eileen Miles, people who are writing fiction like Siri Hustvedt or Lynn Tillman, people who are writing kind of theoretically like Fred Moten. Those were all people that I thought on some fundamental level were all writing about art. They were applying words to try and come to terms with some aspect of the visual, even though they've never been allowed to be contextualized by each other. So on one move, I was like, oh, what if I just acted in a kind of willfully naive way, like as though these people were all doing the same thing, and then see what it would be like if they were on a single horizon. And when you do that, you realize that every single one of them is so different. Their ideas of what they're doing, why they're doing it, what they believe constitutes a work of art, what the ambitions of criticism should be, who it's aimed at, what their relationship to other institutions or writers should be. Every one of them is so specific. And you basically have to invent it for yourself. Even people who are both writing criticism, what's called criticism, for a similar platform, are really approaching it in different ways. And having done that and understood that from the inside, I, as like a younger writer or sort of aspiring writer, it was extremely liberating to be like, oh, I can take control of the things that I want to address and the way I want to address them in a way that it wasn't necessarily clear to me before, because it seemed like being a critic was a certain kind of job. And then you realize, well, first of all, there's not a job. And second of all, even if there was a job, you would still have to figure it out for yourself. So that's the impression that I got from doing the book.
And, you know, and that's kind of fascinating, because as you're saying, they're all different. You think of, you know, it as a job, and it's really not a job. And they're all coming from very different points of view. From, you know, Jerry Saltz to Eileen Miles, Dave Hickey, these are all, you know, like incredibly different figures in how they're approaching work. And often a lot of these critics themselves are at odds with each other. They don't like other critics, or they disagree with them. You know, in terms of that kind of thing, is that something that you know, was there a common denominator? Not that there should be, they're all unique, but they're all people who have a love for art in some form and want to keep interacting with it. Is that what's common among them, or is it writing, or is it something else? You know, I mean, you could also pivot to take that question to something that that you most you know, enjoyed in talking to them, but I'm kind of curious how they thought about each other, how critics think about other critics.
Well, obviously, the majority of the people that are in my book hate the idea that they have anything to do with the rest of the people in the book, except for maybe like one or two of their friends. I think I've always had really strong opinions. And because I have really strong opinions, I understand that they're not worth very much. Like, it's interesting that, like, oh, I like this, I don't like that. But I'm really not interested in those kinds of judgments. Like, there are people that I interviewed in my book that I vehemently disagree with. Like, I really dislike what they do. I don't, it's not what I dislike what they do, but I I am opposed to certain positions that they have articulated in their work, whether it's about writing, whether it's about art. But my opinion about that position is not what's interesting to me going into doing this book. What was interesting to me is that they had figured something out as a writer and as a thinker that I thought was important, and I wanted to understand why it was that they thought the way that they did, or that they wanted art to be in a certain way. And so I actually don't think, when you said, is it a love of art that unites all of them? I don't think so. I think there are people in my book who are important people who write about art who I do not think love art. And some of them do. And I think the difference is very important. Some of them, I think, kind of love artists. Others don't love artists. Some are really committed to writing. I don't even think you could make that kind of generalization. And maybe that is horrifying to, on some level, it must be horrifying if you're someone who believes in the love of art. But the world is a very complicated, polyphonic mix of people who are coming from all different perspectives, and that's actually the thing that I was trying to capture in doing the book the way that I did.
I like that. That makes sense to me. As it's. I like the idea of rising above your own opinions to that, because, right, we all have strong opinions, and often that is what is suspect, right? Very strong opinions. But, you know, critics especially are known for their strong opinions. It's kind of quite a layer then to have on top of that, you know, your opinions of the critics, you know what I mean, to sort out, which of course wasn't what was in the book, but it's what we're talking about briefly. So it seems that's kind of a wonderful way to approach the book, to kind of step back from what your strong opinions are about them, because critics are figures that are polarizing because of their strong opinions, right? That's often how I see them when I, you know, started reading through your book and look at all these names. You know, what immediately comes to mind is what I agree and don't agree with in all these critics, because I've read different aspects of what they write and think, well, I like that, but I don't like that, and I totally don't like that and completely agree with that. So it seems that, unlike a lot of other writers, their writing is specifically almost designed to be divisive. Would you agree with that or no?
Well, I included Dave Hickey in my book, and I really love Dave Hickey as a person and as a writer. And one thing he said that comes up for me a lot is that he says, when two curators agree, it's a trend. When two critics agree, one of them's irrelevant. And I think that means that as a critic, your job is to try and put forward a new interpretation or a different argument. Let people see something else. And so by design, that means that a critic has to be, it's not for everyone, because that's not, because then you're not having a discussion. And I think criticism is profoundly about having discussion. The other thing that is in the background of the question you just asked me is I've listened to your interviews with Linda Montano over the years, and she was a big influence on me in the book of interviews that she did called Performance Artists Talking in the 80s, which I read when I was in art school in San Francisco. And it was influential because it was an artist who was doing interviews as an art form, basically as a form of performance. But also she was really trying to figure something out. She was trying to figure out why these people who were making performances were doing what they were doing, and because she wanted to know. And I think the character of Linda in the interviews, as opposed to Linda as a person, is at times like abrasive, annoying, really funny, extremely tender, and she really comes across as being in a dynamic interaction with the people that she's interviewing. And because the people that she's interviewing are just, they're artists, but they also just happen to be people. And that was something that was really important to me about what it means to write about art, was to make a book in which someone could access a critic as a person, as a person that's a really complicated entity that has all kinds of, you know, personal, emotional undercurrents and structures which are dictating the kinds of opinions that they hold and the arguments they make about art. Whereas I feel like the way that critics function, it's very hard to get a sense of, like, where they're coming from. If you're an artist, if you're just a normal artist who has a show and it gets panned by Roberta Smith, wouldn't it be kind of helpful if you could have some sense of who Roberta Smith is and why her thoughts and opinions were formed in the way that they were? I think it would be really productive and also maybe take the sting out a little bit. I mean, Roberta's brilliant. She has one of the most exquisite eyes of anybody writing, and when we lose her, there's not going to be another one. And I think that's the thing you could say about all these people in the book. You know, it's like after Lucy Lepard's gone, we're not getting another Lucy Lepard. there's not right. A double.
Yeah, that's so true, and so interesting. Yeah, what you're saying about Linda Montana, she's a fascinating figure to me, and you know, she gave me one of the suggestions that turned out to be most ironic. I was going to interview Ulay, you know, Marina Abramović's old partner, and meeting him in this apartment in New York just a few years ago. And on the way there, I just posted on Facebook, anybody have a question I should ask Ulay? And she said, yes, ask him, what is the most important thing? But, you know, that's kind of interesting and odd, right? So I'm sitting down there, and he's sitting there smoking away like crazy, you know, chain-smoking cigarettes. And I said, what is the most important thing? And he said, fresh air and water. That's it, you know. It was really so wonderful and odd, because here we are in this, like, completely polluted environment. But, yeah, something kind of wonderful about her sensibility and the way she used to interview artists as well. And I mean, something tragic when I asked her about it, and I think that's in the interview too, she kept recording over the same tape, you know. So
yeah.
Most of the interviews she has are they don't exist. She'd take what she wanted from them and just kept using the same cassette over and over. Fascinating figure. Let's talk about your show at David Zwirner. I want to get into that, but I'd like to hear first about how you potentially propose that show and what your idea was for that show.
Well, the show as it came about at Zwirner was really a conversation. I would say that a conversation that was partly fate. You know, I just trust things to work out that are supposed to work out. I'm not interested in forcing anything. And so I would say when I was in art school in San Francisco, I found some of those artists through, I had a teacher who was a poet named Bill Berkson, who I believe you interviewed.
Yeah, I interviewed him. Yeah, wonderful guy.
So Bill was really influential to me and introduced me was the person who started me writing. He basically was like, I was a total brat, and he was like, oh, you've got all these opinions. Why don't you write them down? And I thought, it never occurred to me that it was possible. And it took a long time for me to feel like it was possible, but he really supported me and read everything that I wrote and talked to me about it for years and years. Through him, I got turned on to Frank O'Hara, as many people have been, and to Edwin Denby. And through Edwin Denby, I was learning about the New York City Ballet and Lincoln Kirstein and Balanchine, and found this milieu in which Lincoln Kirstein, who wrote a book on Paul Cadmus, he wrote a book on Pavel Chelichev, and it was this little gay world, this kind of like chic, weird, like world of gay art that really didn't fit in historically with anything that I had learned in my Art Since 1900 textbook, you know, of like the October approved lineage of American modernism. And so I was interested in it at that time. My boyfriend at the time was a dancer, and I definitely gave him the Lincoln Kirstein monograph on Paul Cadmus as like a present. I wish I remembered what it was for. It was either for a birthday, it was for Valentine's Day or something, or it was just to say I love you. But so that was a seed that was planted, and it was a kind of idea that I was always interested in, which is alternate histories. And I think that there's a sense of that that animates the book of Interviews with Critics and the book I edited, Tell Me Something Good, which is how do we understand differently the work that people were making, the lives that they led, the relationships that they led, that's different than the way it has been historicized, because history is just a story. You know, I love Genesis Peorage, the artist, who also happens to be a close friend of mine, and she always calls it a story, which I think makes sense. First of all, because it kind of disgenders it in like a 70s feminist way where it's not his story, but it's just a story. It's a possible story. And I think what we have to be doing as critics, as historians, as writers, as thinkers, as artists, is constantly deconstructing that story and finding a new story, a story that fits more evocatively, expansively, beautifully, the reality that we're living in, the world that we're trying to build together. So I really felt like the narrative of American art or of modernism that I received in history books was not useful. It was not accommodating the things I was interested in. And I had the glimmer on the periphery that there was these kind of chic, weird guys from the 30s and 40s in New York. And so completely separately, one of the directors of David's Werner, Robert Goff, who when he was a student was studying Wyndham Lewis in literature and was very interested in some of these guys, proposed doing a small show to David's Werner of some of these artists. And David thought it was a really good idea, but thought it should be a kind of bigger show and that they should get an outside person who would have a kind of fresh take on it, and thought of me. And of course, whenever they said, you know, would you be interested in this? I thought, you know, I've waited my whole life. You know, it's like Lisa Yuskavich always talks about like finding the sword, like the sword in the stone as an artist. And you could describe it, like she says, you know, if you were going to personify a color in a painting and make that the painting, it sounds like an easy thing to do, but like you can tug on it, and if you're not King Arthur, it doesn't come out. And so that was kind of the way with the show, where I was like, yeah, of course. I would do that, because I've been thinking about doing that for years without even realizing it. And as I developed it, as I got into the research of it and I started finding things, the show really took shape and it grew and it moved into a bigger space. And so I kind of really molded it. But that's how it came about.
And so the show seems enormously ambitious, right? And to talk about alternative histories, maybe I can jump right into my experience of the show. It was packed and almost like the way I walk through the Met, I just bounce around the room to things that are drawing me into them, you know, not carefully going one by one to each one, but that draws me in or that draws me in. And I was kind of, you know, immediately just, you know, struck by the beauty of these. You know, there's gorgeous work in here, and it was also most of it to me fairly subtle in terms of what was beautiful about it. These weren't loud works. These weren't, or most of them weren't. These were works that were filled with subtleties. And the first thing that I came across, well, the first thing was you in high heels. I see you there, and it's like, okay, there's Jared. I'll go say hello to him soon. And then I walk over to, I'm drawn to these George Platt lines, if I'm saying his name right, right? Which is, of course, the photographer I know. And I see this image that looks like him holding an angel upside down. These are, I guess, platinum or palladium prints that are gorgeous, right? I love photography, and I'm looking at these, and they're so luscious and amazing. You feel like you can touch them. You like you can touch the materials in them. And then as I start moving around, I see another set of prints by him that I've never seen before. And I'm just a huge fan of photography. Not that I have any kind of, exhaustive sense of the history of photography, but I certainly know a bit about him. And then I see these prints that are really erotic prints, right? With penises in them, erect penises, and men. And I'm kind of struck dumb. I think, where are these from? I've never seen these before. And it's hard for me to believe that who are these? Is this him? And so I ran to the front desk and I said, what are those prints over there? You know, those kind of erotic prints, are those plot lines? You know, tell me something about those. And they said, yeah, that is plot lines. They've never been exhibited before. That was from a personal collection. And still, that stays with me. I looked around at the rest of the show, and it was beautiful work in there. And of course, chatted with you a bit there. But that, those two pieces, and it was interesting that they were on different walls, right? There was many pieces in between those two, and then this whole series of erotic work that, as someone behind the counter said, and just correct me if that's wrong, or I'd like to know more about how you got those and what that's about. What were those, that series that seemed to be, or that I was told were so personal and never exhibited? What was happening there? Where did you get those prints, and what are they?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for describing your experience of looking and what you saw. I really did think of the show. I wanted it to be something that you would learn about by looking at it, which weirdly in institutional settings is not what happens. You know, it's like things that are so overdetermined because it's as though museum curators think that people are so stupid that they can't figure out what they're looking at. Whereas, like, to me, art is about looking at it. So I really tried to work on creating a space in which the things told the story. As you notice, it's not wall text, it's not didactics, it's kind of like, just look at it. So I appreciated the way you explained it, and I couldn't imagine a sort of more satisfying narrative about looking at the show than you just gave me. And so those particular prints, there were four of them on the wall, they were photographs that were taken by George Platlines of his lover, of him and his lover, whose name was Monroe Wheeler. And Monroe Wheeler was a publisher and later head of exhibitions and publications at the Museum of Modern Art for a long time. And so he had this very serious love affair with Monroe Wheeler for about 10 years. Monroe Wheeler was also in a relationship with the novelist Gwenway Westcott for that time. And so they had a kind of loose threesome and lived together, although the real kind of sustained, passionate love affair for George was with Monroe, not with Gwenway. And there's, as you know, just to the right of that series of four photographs that you mentioned is a Paul Cadmus painting of the three of them together in front of the house that they lived in New Jersey. So that's there. And then you look at those four photos. They were taken, I talked to the George Platlines historian who's finishing an authoritative biography. His name's Alan Ellenzweig. And I've talked to the George Platlines Foundation people about trying to date them because they aren't dated. But what happened was after Monroe Wheeler died, the executor of his estate was going through his papers and found two envelopes, brown envelopes. One was marked MWGPL private, and the other just said intimacies. And inside the envelopes were these photographs of them in very close proximity to each other, close-ups of Monroe Wheeler's hard dick, also someone's getting their dick sucked, but it's cropped very closely to just the mouth and the cock. Also, there's an image, as you know, of the two of their faces lying very close together asleep. And so those are dated to around 1930, the early 30s. And like you, I've never seen an image like that before. At least I've never seen an image like that from that period. And the quality of the print is so fine and so subtle. Many people who saw the show thought they were drawing, thought they were some kind of extremely soft, sensitive drawing, which I think I looked at these photographs and they were just so suffused with tenderness, you know, with real intimacy. And to have a close-up photograph of a hard dick with like a little glistening drop of pre-cum at the top and it not feel pornographic, but to be just so much about love and closeness between people. I thought it was amazing. And I knew that that was what I wanted the whole show to be about. And it was really important to me that those be framed and put on the wall and then put in the wall in a very prominent way that wasn't like, oh, I hope that you don't notice that there's these hard dicks on the wall. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I have like that one wall that's like a big cloud of, you know, so many photographs. And it's not like, oh, I'm gonna hide them in there. I'm not going to put them in a vitrine. I'm going to say, like, really, just this is what this is about. And it's going to be very clear. And look at it or think about it or you know, or don't, you know, or leave. And so that somehow was conceptually very important to me to not treat them like ephemera. And the thing is with the show, as you know, is I mixed up everything. I mixed up all the different artists' work. I mixed up the media. I mixed up the kind of things they're dealing with. And I wanted to have a kind of an emotional narrative as you move through it. But their vitrines are a big part of that show. And in the vitrines, there's a mixture of like, of photographs that would be considered artworks, photographs that would be personal ephemera, objects that would be considered like just personal, almost talismanic objects, books that had to do with it, and drawings. And so all of that kind of was just like somehow put onto a level with each other or put in dialogue with each other in a non-hierarchical way. You know, I think a lot of the stuff that I chose to include in the show has never been exhibited before, and most people would choose not to exhibit it and have chosen not to exhibit it. In some cases, a lot of that work was work that was made in the context of friends in a collaborative way or made specifically for another artist, personal collection, and it's often stayed in private hands. In some cases, with those most explicit works, I know that there have been museums that are still not comfortable acquiring it, you know, like, so that was the story with those works. It was really about trying to show a relationship between two people who are characters in the show.
I love that because that strikes me as why there is a kind of an intimacy to the whole show. That, you know, it struck me as sort of a delicate quality, but that's not really it, and that's kind of inarticulate. But there's an intimacy to it, and something that's very subtle about it, which I think you just articulated very, very clearly in how you approach that. So you're in choosing a lot of these works. I mean, one more question, just about putting these together, the way those you know, George Plattline's images were found in this folder. I imagine there's more stories you have from that. So the show itself seems like it was quite an extensive research project, you know, that also required intimacy as opposed to, you know, with talking to different places and different people, as opposed to how it could have been curated, which is borrowing from certain collections of what's already available online that you can see everywhere. You're showing things that haven't been shown before in many cases, or certainly not very much, it sounds like.
Well, no, you really put your finger on it. And I think partly that relates to just the way that I work. I mean, I think, you know, I went to art school, I studied conceptual art, and a lot of what I learned with doing things as conceptual art, and I think you and I have a lot of overlap in the way that our work moved into certain directions in this regard, is that it's all about creating a framework. And if you just if you conceptualize the shape of it, then the rest of it just kind of gets worked out. And so, I think the book of interviews with critics that I did for myself makes as much sense as a conceptual artwork as it does, a book about criticism. And the same thing with this show. And so one of the ways that I work is that I'm like a really good, like, freaky researcher. Like, I'm not a good academic researcher, and which is why I did not have the right temperament to be a scholar, nor really the interest. But what I do have the right temperament to do is a kind of really insane, wacky research. So the way that manifested in the art critics book is that I would read everything that they had written in chronological order before I interviewed them, which is what I developed with artists, the difference being that with artists, you could read everything that's been written about a very famous artist, like Luke Poymans, for example, in just like a couple days. It's not that bad. But when you start talking about someone like Michael Fried, or someone who's written a ton of books over 40 or 50 years, then you're talking about serious reading. And it really kind of took over my reading life for about a year doing that project. But that was part of the concept. That was part of the structure. And I was like, okay, I just got to do the structure. So with this show, it was about that kind of research. It was about seeing someone's name in a collection line from a monograph 30 years ago, tracking that person down, driving to their house to see it, driving to the Kinsey Institute in Indiana and spending a week going through their archives with them. And they were really amazing. I'm very proud of the Kinsey material because it's never been shown. Because the Kinsey is not an art institution, it's a scientific institution, and people didn't know what was there in terms of those Cadmus drawings and Chelyuchov drawings. So the same thing with Paul Cadmus's estate.
And just to frame that for a second, so the Kinsey Institute, for listeners that don't know, as I know about it, is an institute that's been researching sexual behavior since, I don't know whether it's the turn of the century or later, and has been collecting an enormous amount of material and art on sexual behavior, which moved into all kinds of arenas, gay, mm-hmm. bisexual, I don't know, all kinds of fetishes and other things, right? Am I paraphrasing what Kinsey Institute is correct?
No. I mean, you're getting that. That's correct. Yeah, it's part of the University of Indiana in Bloomington, and it was Alfred Kinsey's research institute. And of course, he was a zoologist, and then moved into studying human sexuality in a scientific way, and accumulated this amazing archive of, I don't know, I think they have over 100,000 objects there. And just related to human sexuality. And some of those things are just like salt shakers shaped like dicks. And some of those things are like several hundred George Platt Lines photographs. So, the lines that are there are quite famous because it was like a weird big deal that they ended up there, largely because George Platt Lines believed that the most important work that he did was his erotic photographs of naked men. And in the 50s, he didn't feel like there was an institution that they could go to that they would be taken care of, or that they would not be censored. And he also needed money. And so he worked out a thing with Kinsey where he sold the, several thousand negatives and several hundred prints to them.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea that they had that huge a collection.
What I wanted to tell you is that Paul Cadmus, who is like an important artist in the show, he's probably one of the more famous artists in the show.
Yeah, he is. And of course, the works there were amazing of him. But yeah, go on. I could have talked a lot about those. But yeah, tell me about Paul Cadmus, what you were going to say.
Well, I ended up working closely with Paul Cadmus's partner, lover. They were together for decades and decades, named John Anderson. John Anderson lived in Connecticut in the house that he shared with Paul. And the house was just full of thousands of artworks. And uh, we were working together, going through stuff, and we were just going through drawers, like in this big studio where all the drawings were, and we found this drawer that was full of these little pencil drawings by Fidelma Cadmus. Fidelma Cadmus was Paul Cadmus's sister, who was married to Lincoln Kirstein. And I was like, wow, these are amazing. I've never seen them. And John was like, I didn't know we had them. I didn't know they existed. And so those are another thing. It's like, you know, I knew that she was an artist as a child and that she stopped making art probably in the mid-30s or early 40s, but no one would have ever seen them. And I was, that was something that was really important to me. It's like, okay, this is someone who's an important person in this world, and these are these weird little drawings that she made, and I want to put them in the show. One thing that was extremely sad, you might have noticed that on the wall text outside the gallery, it says that the exhibition is dedicated to John Anderson. At the end of last year, suddenly and completely unexpectedly, John died. And that was just such a sorrow because I really adored him. And we became really good friends. And he was such a supporter of this show. He was so enthusiastic. And he would have just loved it. And there was a lot of other things that I wanted to do with him in the future. And it was such a sadness that happened in like sort of last November. So I just wanted to share. But if I hadn't started working with him a year ago, who knows what would have happened to all those things, you know, or what would have happened to them after he's died. I mean, they wouldn't have been thrown out, but they probably, you know, a lot of them, John is the only person who knew what they were. He could say, oh, that's, you know, Paul told me that this is so-and-so, or Paul told me that this is a drawing of this person. And, you know, all that information, I mean, I got some of it from him when we were working together, but there's still so much more that's just gone.
Wow. Yeah, of course. It is so sad, and what's lost in terms of information when someone dies. Jared, it's great talking to you about this. I hope the listeners will come and see this show. I know I'll visit it again. And I want to ask you one more question that's a little off topic, but I'm curious what you're reading at the moment.
Okay. I love that question. I'm always reading. There's two things I'm reading right now. One is a book it's sort of related, is a book called On the Rock, which is by an artist named Allison Vieira, which is like V-I-E-I-R-A or something. I can't remember exactly how to spell her name. And she did this project, which was so brilliant, where she interviewed the marble carvers that are restoring the Acropolis in Greece. And they've all been educated in this very specific way, in this very specific marble carving school. And it's, you know, it's this amazing thing. And so it's a book of interviews that she did with them called On the Rock that a publisher I really like in Chicago named Sober Cove just brought out. The other book that I'm reading is, which I'm just obsessed with, is Jonathan Cott, who to me is the best interviewer of all in terms of people who do books of interviews. I think his book is the smartest. And, the book with Stockhausen is just amazing. But the book I'm reading is called The Search for Om Sati, Reincarnation and Eternal Love. And it's a story of a woman named Dorothy Eddy, who was an early 20th century Egyptologist, English woman who believed that she was a reincarnated ancient Egyptian. And she made really important contributions to modern Egyptology with information that she basically received through mystical means. And, you know, I totally believe her. And the way that Jonathan Cott writes the book is just like so gorgeous and compelling. So those are the two things I'm reading.
Jared, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today and also putting together that fantastic show at David Zwirner and the books you've been publishing and working on and editing. Thank you so much, Jared.
Thank you so much, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.